following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
Angular, cassis, opulent. If you aren't familiar with those wine terms, congratulations, you're just like me. I don't care if wine clubs and critics babble on about herbaceousness. I just want to know, does it taste good? Luckily, I found First Leaf, the only wine club that's based on your tastes. I just received my First Leaf order, and these are some good wines. Here's how it works. Customize your First Leaf order by selecting the color, wine regions, and frequency of your wine shipments. First Leaf then creates an introductory 3-pack of wine to get you started. I got my 3-pack recently, and this will show you how much I know about wine. It has 2 reds and a white. But having those wines on hand has been amazing for board game nights with friends. Normally, I'd have to run out at the last minute, figure out what kind of wine to buy, how much to spend, and feel self-conscious about whether I'm getting good bottles. But this time, I already had my First Leaf bottles on hand. Not only did I feel super prepared, but my friends love the wine. With First Leaf's introductory pack, you'll get all 3 for just $5 each. Normally, these bottles of wine go for $20 each, if not more. When your bottles arrive, rate the wine to get personalized selections based on your unique tastes. The more wines you rate, the better your recommendations will be. First Leaf eliminates the middleman and works directly with the world's foremost wineries in France, Italy, and Napa Valley. First Leaf is my new favorite way to rate and buy quality wine. To order your 3-pack of introductory wine for $15, go to tryfirstleaf.com/coldcase. That's 3 bottles of wine for only $15 at tryfirstleaf.com/coldcase. Experience First Leaf today at tryfirstleaf.com/coldcase.
It was someone who was clearly stalking an individual for the purpose of sex. 6 weeks later, he sees some more prey. Follows her into her house, attempts to take sex. And when she defends herself, he is not afraid to turn in a moment and turn it into a homicide.
In January of 2000, Albany Police Sergeant P.J. McKenna received a strange call. An elderly woman had been found wandering around the streets of Albany, lost and confused. Some neighbors found her and helped her home, but when police arrived on the scene, they found blood and evidence of an attack. The woman, who was 85 years old, had dementia and couldn't remember much about what happened, only that someone had hurt her. Who would attack a helpless old woman, and why? Unfortunately, it would take another 5 years and 2 victims to bring this woman's attacker to light. And the trail along the way has left some to wonder, could these attacks have been prevented? From A&E, this is Cold Case Files, the podcast. I'm Brooke, and this story, adapted from a classic episode of Cold Case Files, is told by the one and only Bill Curtis.
What are we bringing upstairs?
We got the bedspread from Martha Montalvo's house.
Inside a police evidence room, these men are collecting items from a cold case.
Each of these items have significant DNA evidence. All these were marked out.
Among them, a bedspread.
The killer actually would have wiped his hands on this comforter as he left.
A pair of jeans.
And you can actually see there is blood all over jeans.
And a steel bar.
Someone had stood over him and repeatedly thrust down with this.
For Sergeant P.J. McKenna, unwrapping the evidence is easy. Unwrapping this investigation, however, is another story. One that takes him back to a cold night in Albany 6 years earlier.
A call went out to the patrol division for a woman in the area, and there was a complaint of a potential assault.
At 8:30 p.m., Albany Police Detective P.J. McKenna rolls to 799 Myrtle Avenue. An 85-year-old woman has been found wandering the neighborhood.
We were informed that she was in the early stages, at the very least, of dementia, and really couldn't provide much, only to say that he had hurt her.
Inside the old woman's house, McKenna finds blood and evidence of a possible rape.
Nothing was taken, but the phone cords were pulled out. It was the phone cord that was actually tied up in a knot, as if used for holding something, tying someone up.
With no identified suspects, the case is not a priority for DNA testing. Eventually, a DNA profile is extracted from semen found on the victim's body and entered into the state's data bank as an unsolved case.
With no one in the neighborhood being able to know anything, nothing off canvas, nothing off registered or known sex offenders, it went cold. We had no leads in this case.
50-year-old Martha Montalvo was discovered stabbed to death by her landlord, who looked through a rear window and saw Martha laying in a pool of blood.
As we went into the house, you passed through a living room.
Less than 2 months later, Detectives McKenna and Tim Carroll arrive at the apartment of Martha Montalvo, a 50-year-old woman with a history of mental illness. Inside, they find a dead body and a crime scene already several days gone cold.
There was no forced entry, there was no struggle by the doors. She was decomposed, advanced stages of decomposition. Her buttocks was propped up on some pillows. She was partially naked. There was a towel draped on her face, and she was blood-soaked.
And we had both said, after speaking to dozens of people in the area and seeing the scene, that this was going to be a forensic case. It was going to be something where we were going to need a forensic break.
An autopsy reveals no evidence of semen in the body. The victim's blood-stained jeans and bedding are sent out for DNA testing. Meanwhile, the story gets a lot of play in the press.
A quiet Albany neighborhood filled with families has been plunged into concern and fear by the murder of a woman who lived alone at 1071 Madison Avenue.
The news coverage generates attention, then a phone call, and Detective McKenna's first solid lead.
And a phone call came in from a person who identified himself as Adam Scope. He told us that he was a friend of hers and that he was concerned about what had happened and he'd known her for a long time and he wanted to offer his assistance in any way to the investigation.
We were just acquaintances. We saw each other once in a while.
Like Montalvo, Adam Scope has a history of mental illness, along with a history of sexual violence towards women. McKenna decides to pay him a visit.
When we went to speak to him, it was very difficult to keep him on point on any question. He would go off on tangents.
They were like playing good cop, bad cop with me, you know?
We could attribute some of that to his telling us that he was on medication and that may affect his thought process. But it was difficult to tell if he was avoiding questions and being evasive in his answers or if he was actually having a problem coming up with clear thoughts.
They were pressuring me to admit to killing Martha. And I didn't, I wouldn't, and couldn't. And I just felt like I was being arrested without being told I was being arrested.
After two interviews with police, Scope realizes he has become a suspect in the murder and decides to approach the media with his side of the story.
Adam Scope lives just a few doors away from what was once the home of 50-year-old Martha Montalvo.
We interviewed Adam Scope after he contacted us here at News 10. He said that he was very interested in trying to figure out who killed Martha Montalvo.
TV reporter Sarah Welch interviews Scope. Like detectives, she finds his story has some holes.
When we interviewed him, said that he clearly had an alibi for the night that Martha Montalvo was murdered. However, at the time, police had not yet released a specific date as to when Martha was killed.
Well, you and your girlfriend saw Martha on Sunday, and her body was found on Monday. The coroner says that Martha had been dead for at least a couple of days.
No.
At one point, he did tell us that he didn't know Martha very well. However, in the next breath, he told us that he loved her, or he thought that he loved her. His comments were at times very unpredictable, borderline strange and bizarre.
Bizarre maybe, but to detectives, Scope's performance on the evening news is something they've seen before.
You know, my first thought was Wayne Williams from the Atlanta child killings. He was very close with the police, very close to the investigation, and very close to the media at the same time. I mean, that was a classic scenario. So here we have a person doing the same thing, and you have to ask, is this person following that same pattern? Is he directly involved?
Police suspect Adam Scope might be their killer. The problem is a matter of proof, until a forensic scientist takes a look at the victim's bloodstained genes.
The minute I got those genes out of the bag and looked at them, I thought, this is going to be a very interesting case. Well, I remember that I was called upstairs and told that this was a high-priority case.
On March 24th, Dr. Allison Eastman takes possession of a pair of bloodstained genes. They once belonged to Martha Montalvo, a woman found stabbed to death in her apartment.
On the front side, there was a single drop of blood located right near the pocket that looked like it was totally unrelated to the other blood.
It was assumed all the blood on the jeans belonged to the victim. Eastman sees the small round drop and thinks otherwise.
What I thought it might have, what might have happened is that someone leaned over her body and the blood fell from that individual, as though the individual was leaning over her body and blood fell, possibly from a cut, and deposited like that, forming a small circle.
Eastman's suspicions are well-founded, as a male DNA profile is developed from the stain.
This is a vial of Adam Scope's blood, which we obtained via search warrant.
Detective P.J. McKenna has one good suspect in the case, an acquaintance of the victim named Adam Scope.
He looked good in the beginning. He did. He fit a lot of the criteria that we were looking at, and when it came back negative, it was just, okay, well, let's move on.
Scope is not a match for the mysterious bloodstain. An initial run through the state's DNA databank also fails to generate a suspect. Two years later, however, detectives get a hit, not to an individual, but to the unsolved rape of an 85-year-old woman committed just 6 weeks before the Montalvo homicide and only five blocks away.
In the first case, it was someone who was clearly stalking an individual for the purpose of sex. And 6 weeks later, he sees some more prey, follows her into her house, attempts to take sex, and when she defends herself, he is not afraid to turn in a moment and turn it into a homicide and kill her to put her down.
Detective McKenna believes he is looking for a sexual predator, one who targets older or vulnerable women. Detective McKenna, however, is wrong.
We'll be right back after this break. Let me give you a challenge. Find a gift that's affordable, practical, and Instagram-worthy. On top of that list is Quip, the electric toothbrush that looks like it was designed by Apple without the high price. Let's be honest. You're supposed to brush your teeth for 2 minutes twice a day. But do you? Whether your answer is yes, no, or maybe, you need Quip, the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into an ultra-slim design with guiding pulses to simplify better brushing at a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. Quip comes with a mount that goes right on your mirror, fitting seamlessly into your daily routine. Quip also offers an optional subscription plan, delivering new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And just in time for the holidays, Quip is the ideal size and price to gift anyone on your list. You can even include automatic brush head deliveries for a year to ensure your gift keeps giving until the next holiday. The Quip electric toothbrush is featured in just about every gift-giving guide this year, like Refinery29, Goop, GQ, and Oprah's O-List. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Quip starts at just $25, and right now, go to getquip.com cc.com/coldcase to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/coldcase, spelled GETQUIP.com/coldcase. Quip is the perfect gift for three reasons. It's a gift they'll actually use every day, not something that'll be thrown in a drawer. It makes a boring part of your day enjoyable. You don't have to go to a store to get it. Quip can ship directly to your door or theirs. It's that perfect $25 price point for those secret Santas you struggle with every year. You can even gift Quip with automatic brush head deliveries for a year to keep their brush effective and mouth healthy until the next holiday. A gift that literally keeps on giving. With Quip, you don't have to worry about getting new brush heads or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door, on schedule. So you replace your brush on time and have better oral hygiene at an affordable price. With the sleekest design you've ever seen for an electric toothbrush. 75% of us don't refresh our bristles every 3 months, let alone visit the dentist every 6. That's why you need Quip, to put necessary, yet annoying, aspect of your personal care on autopilot. Quip will even give you tips on oral care that you probably never knew. The Quip toothpaste tastes fresh, strengthens teeth, and gives your mouth the perfect minty clean feeling. Its wireless mirror mount declutters your bathroom and doubles as a travel cover, so it's the easiest and most refreshing travel companion. Quip's subscription model is a thoughtful, inexpensive solution for people who want to make it easy to keep up with the simple habits that will improve their oral health. Let Quip do the thinking for you when it comes to your teeth. Quip has been called the Apple, Warby Parker, and Tesla of toothbrushes. It will be love at first brush. No charger or wires means Quip is compact and light to make brushing twice daily easy, at home and on the road. Go to getquip.com/coldcase to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/coldcase. GETQUIP.com/coldcase.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
Detective PJ McKenna of the Albany Police Department had an unsolved rape of an 85-year-old woman with dementia and an unsolved murder of a 50-year-old woman with mental illness, which appeared to have started as a sexual assault. McKenna felt sure these cases were connected and that a sexual predator was on the loose and wasn't afraid to kill. There'd only been one real suspect, but despite his odd behavior and inconsistent story, the DNA evidence ultimately didn't support his involvement. 4 years later, the attacker struck again, and as it turned out, McKenna was right about those two cases being connected. His theory about why, though, was very wrong.
We have an apparent homicide of a 68-year-old Alexander Street resident.
George Young, an Army veteran, lived alone in his Alexander Street home.
It was so violent. Right here, when they came through the door, he had to stand up to open the door. And he was laying here almost like in a fetal position.
Just after 12 noon, P.J. McKenna and Detective Jack Grogan respond to the home of 69-year-old George Young. Inside, they find Mr. Young beaten, bloody, and dead.
And the pool of blood that Mr. Young was laying in, you could see that it was an extremely violent crime that happened here.
And when forensics got here, as you looked up to the ceiling, you could tell that whoever was doing it was lifting and striking and lifting and striking and moving around him as they hit him over and over again. And you'd have blood spatter all the way back in an outward pattern away in every direction.
Detectives find an unlocked safe near the body, indicating robbery to be the likely motive. Also near the body, a bloody piece of steel, otherwise known as rebar.
Just looking at the position of George Young and the way his head looked, to me, that looked pretty obvious that was probably the murder weapon.
An autopsy determines that George Young was both beaten and shot. While detectives don't recover a gun, this news bolsters their theory that this was a two-man operation.
When one of them brought the safe down, they stopped right about here, and they put the safe on the floor. While this was going on, the other one was beating George still.
He beat him numerous times in his head, about the body, From the injuries that we could see from the autopsy photos, it was numerous to count.
Detectives hit the street, hoping to find out who knew what about George Young's money.
Everyone in that part of town, which is economically depressed, said that George had money.
He wouldn't let people in his house unless he knew who they were. I mean, that's one of the things that piqued our interest when we found Mr. Young. How did somebody get into his house? Not by not forcing the door. He had to let them in, so he had to know who they were.
Detectives learn of a handyman who did odd jobs for the victim. Someone George Young would have allowed into his home. Someone already familiar to police.
This was someone who had a checkered history. His name had come up in a previous investigation, a previous homicide investigation. His name was on a short list of possibilities amongst street people.
The handyman is brought in for questioning and denies killing Young.
We also asked him to take a polygraph, which he initially agreed to, and then, as hard as it is to imagine for a person who was in his 40s, refused to cooperate any further unless his mother could be in the interview room with him at all times. He didn't want a lawyer, he wanted his mom.
The handyman ultimately refuses to take a polygraph. Meanwhile, evidence from the crime scene is examined for possible clues. Of particular interest, the probable murder weapon.
Ultimately, the decision was made by our forensics unit to send it out for identification in the hopes that whoever had taken this, I mean, when you use this with such force, if you're not wearing gloves, you can cut your hand on the metal, or as it twists in your hand, you can leave skin scrapings behind.
The actual piece of rebar in the case was longer.
On February 11th, criminalist Nicole Zavotek examines the piece of rebar used to kill George Young.
Appeared that the way the rebar...
She focuses on the end with very little blood, believing it to be the end most likely handled by the killer.
I took another swab towards the very end, and that's the swab, DNA-wise, that ended up yielding a mixture profile.
It's a mixture of blood from the victim and a little something from the killer.
Most likely it's skin cells, shed skin cells, or from sweat.
The partial profile is plugged into CODIS. It doesn't match to any offenders in the system or to a voluntary DNA sample taken from George Young's handyman. But investigators do get a match, one that takes them by surprise.
And we got a case-to-case hit on this case with two other previous cases.
A hit to two crimes that have already been linked. The sexual assault of an 85-year-old Albany woman and the murder of 50-year-old Martha Montalvo.
It was an unbelievable revelation when it came back from the lab. Scary. You know, these people just, they had no connection to each other. They had none.
DNA has connected the dots for detectives. Three crimes, one person. Now the hunt is on to find out who.
It was someone who was very much alive, someone who was still very much active, unfortunately, and had expanded not only their area, but their MO. It hurt, you know, to know that someone who had eluded us, eluded me initially, for 2.5 years, had gone out and killed somebody else. And, you know, there's a sense of responsibility there. The first two had a sexual nature to them. There was a rape. And then there was a murder in the middle of an attempted sexual attack. And they're females, both with some form of mental illness. And now you have a 65-year-old male in the complete opposite end of town who's bludgeoned to death. I mean, it took a right-hand turn. It made no sense initially.
The lack of any identifiable pattern makes the investigation difficult. Then McKenna takes yet another call from the forensics lab.
You know, that day when DCJS told us all three cases had a name to it, I mean, Jack and I wanted to run out the door.
Forensics has matched the unknown profile to a convicted felon named Ramon McGill.
We had no idea who he was. He was no one that was on our radar. His name had never come up, never come up in any crimes.
McGill is sitting in a New York State prison on an unrelated robbery conviction from earlier in the year.
Going through his criminal history,
very petty stuff. I mean, some drug arrests and that attempted robbery, but other than that, nothing. Nothing major.
Nothing major, and no substantial ties to any of the victims. A DNA match, however, would seem to be enough for a conviction.
You know, how many crimes could he have committed?
Assistant DA Michael McDermott disagrees.
If the only proof we had was that we found his DNA at the scene, I mean, that's really compelling proof, but I think the jury's going to want more. Like, how did he get there? You know, who was he? Why was he there? How did he get in? You know, what happened after the fact? And without a statement from him, we wouldn't be able to fill in those blanks. You know, if you have a skilled defense attorney, they could come up with a million cockamamie reasons why their client's DNA was, you know, found at a crime scene, you know?
The order from the district attorney's office is simple. Get a confession. Detectives McKenna and Grogan pack their bags and head upstate for a chat with their suspect.
PJ and I were expecting to see a monster, and we didn't see that. We saw what appeared to be a very scared 22-year-old kid.
Detectives sit McGill down and get down to business, beginning with the most recent murder.
We just started with, you know, did you ever know George Young? And first he denied it.
Asked him if he'd ever been in this house, old George's house, and he said no.
Detectives know they've caught McGill in a lie and begin to unpack their evidence for the suspect.
Well, let me show you some paperwork. This is your DNA. And this says that the odds of another person having the same DNA are one in something like 26 billion. So do you want to tell me how it is that your DNA is in this house? Do you want to tell me the truth now?
His shoulders just seemed to, they went down like, you know, now it's time. You know, it's time to tell us what actually happened.
Ramon McGill confesses to beating George Young to death, but he says he didn't do it alone. He names another person as the one who shot Young. The same handyman who refused to take a police polygraph at the time of the murder.
Once old George opens the door, Ramon starts to hit him.
They demanded where the safe was because they knew there was a safe in the house. When the safe was brought down, he asked him the combination. The combination was wrong, and he started striking again and again. And with George's dying breath, he gave the correct numbers to the combination to stop the beating.
McGill says his accomplice then shot George Young in the head, and they took off with about $1,200 in cash. Detectives next press McGill about Martha Montalvo.
He was confronted again with the DNA, and he was told, you told us what you did on Alexander Street. You told us that the DNA down there was yours. So how do you explain your DNA? And there was this pause, and he looks out the window, he looks back, and he said, okay, that was me, I was there, I killed her.
McGill again takes detectives back to the night he murdered Martha Montalvo.
He told us that he had followed her into the house. He told us that he attempted to engage her in kissing and petting, and he started to get her clothes off when he said she freaked out.
There was a little bit of a struggle. Ramon stated to us that Martha grabbed the knife and he took it away.
He stabbed her 16 times in the chest.
Detectives now have two confessions. And go for the third.
PJ said to Ramon, he said, we need to discuss one more incident.
Is there any place else you think we might find your DNA? And that's when he brought up Myrtle Avenue.
PJ said, what happened on Myrtle Avenue?
He said, the old lady, in a question form. And he was asked, what about the old lady? And he said, yeah, we had sex.
Ramon McGill pleads guilty to the murders of Martha Montalvo and George Young, and to the sexual assault on Myrtle Avenue. All that's left, sentencing.
All right, this is a matter of People versus Ramon McGill.
In an Albany courtroom, Ramon McGill faces his past, etched into the faces of the families of his victims.
But today, there is a sense of relief. Perhaps now we can begin to heal, knowing that this his rampage of lawlessness, his campaign of death, has come to an end.
My mother was a very beautiful light, like at sunrise. Her light was put out when Ramon McGill came into our lives.
And I want you to think about how I felt after seeing this new scooter parked in his house blood splattered all over it. Ramon, why did you kill my brother George? What did he do to you to cause you to be so brutal?
When it's the killer's turn to speak, Ramon Miguel fails to muster up an apology or take responsibility.
I would like to say my prayers go out to the victims' families and also that justice is not served here today because the killer, madman, still runs free and I'm being punished for it.
The killer Miguel refers to, the accomplice he says shot George Young, a handyman police had looked at in 2004.
The challenge now is to develop sufficient evidence apart from what McGill has told us to prosecute this other person, because under New York law, we cannot use a co-defendant statement as a basis for a prosecution. We need some evidence, whether it's testimonial or whether it's physical evidence, linking this other person to the commission of the crime, and the police are working on that now.
As for Ramon Miguel, he will serve 40 years to life for his crimes. Investigators say two of those crimes might have been prevented had the killer been forced to provide a DNA sample for a 1999 misdemeanor conviction.
Right now, if you're convicted of a misdemeanor, you have to give up your fingerprints. That's 19th century technology. I mean, that's the way they identified people back at the turn of the century. Why not include their DNA, which is, you know, cutting-edge technology? If you look at the facts of this case, it just cries out to expand the group of people included in the database to include all offenders.
It's an idea supported by Sergeant P.J. McKenna, who 6 years later finally gets to see his suspect off to prison.
It was mission accomplished, 2 out of 3. 2 of the cases are completely closed. 1 of the people involved in the most recent homicide will be eligible for parole when I'm in my mid-80s, so I don't think that he's going to be a threat to society anymore. And in the back of my mind, there's still a little bit of work to be done.
In our research, we couldn't find anything about this handyman since the case went to trial. No articles, no court records, nothing. Raymond McGill's name, however, has been in the news several times in the last few years. Raymond is still in prison, but his case became a prime example cited by the state of New York in 2012 as the government pushed to expand its DNA databank. Prior to 2012, New York collected DNA samples from only around 48% of offenders convicted of crimes. That meant people like Raymond McGill didn't have their DNA collected when they committed crimes like petty theft, as Raymond did in 1999. 6 months later, he assaulted the elderly woman and shortly after, murdered Montalvo. The government argued that had Raymond's DNA been collected in 1999, the other crimes could have been prevented. The DNA databank expansion went through in 2012, and now an additional 400 crimes, including all penal law misdemeanors, require a DNA sample to be collected. Cold Case Files, the podcast, is hosted by Brooke Giddings. Produced by Scott Brody and McKamey Lynn. Our executive producer is Ted Butler. We're edited by Steve Delamater and distributed by Podcast One. This story was adapted from A&E's Cold Case Files, which was produced by Curtis Productions and hosted by the one and only Bill Curtis. Check out more Cold Case Files at aetv.com. and by downloading the A&E app.
Hey, my name is James Petragallo.
I'm Jimmy Wiseman.
Please join us every single Tuesday for Crime in Sports.
So fun.
You like sports?
You don't have to.
Let's just set up a context and find out what an idiot did wrong. What
I
do
like
you say?
It. I'm in.
We're going to do that each and every week. We take an athlete, we break him down, we make fun of everything he's ever done.
Yeah. But in order to do that, we have to build up and tell you all about their career and get you to what, James?
to grace,
right.
and then
right.
watch them fall from grace,
who
as they inevitably
like
do. Join us. Big criminals, small yeah. criminals, sports you've never heard of, yeah. doesn't matter. It's the crime, it's the comedy, it's such a good time. Join us every Tuesday for Crime in Sports.
You can join us every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on all Apple products.
Find us every Tuesday and laugh at people.